Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A little over a month ago, on October 7th, Hamas militants launched a major attack on multiple locations across Israel, killing both civilians and military personnel and taking hundreds of hostages. Israel has responded with extensive bombing campaigns that have devastated the densely populated Gaza Strip, as well as a ground invasion of its territory. Over 11,000 people have been killed in Gaza by the Israeli military's action since the war began, and that's according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. While Israeli officials have revised their death toll from the October 7th attacks to around 1,200, along with over 200 hostages taken. The fighting has also drawn attention to the challenges of maintaining human rights in the conflict area, particularly in Gaza. Increasingly forceful calls for a ceasefire or humanitarian pause, allegations of war crimes or crimes against humanity, and rising concerns about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia here at home. Days after the initial Hamas attack, Professor Keith David Wattenpah, the director of human rights studies at UC Davis, provided an initial analysis of the conflict. Professor Wattenpah returns with a deeper look at the human rights challenges of the current war. Professor Wattenpah, thanks for the time.
Thank you, Vicky. It's wonderful to be here.
So you were on Insight in October, as I just mentioned, days after the initial Hamas attack and Israel's retaliation. Here we are 5 weeks later. How are you feeling? How are you processing everything that's been going on?
So I come back to as part of to express the concern that I have and that many other specialists in human rights and genocide studies have, that there's mounting evidence of crimes against humanity and violations of war crimes in Gaza, that the death toll seems to indicate to us that Israel is failing to live up to its obligations under the Fourth Geneva Convention to take all precautions necessary to limit civilian casualties. So I'm here to talk about that and help us understand how human rights as an analytical technique can help us make sense and to get to some of the reality behind these terrible numbers that we're seeing.
I mean, there's a lot of severe and emotional words that are being used to describe what's happening, especially what we see in Gaza right now. Words and terms like ethnic cleansing, apartheid, war crimes, and genocide. But these words also have real, distinct definitions. What are they?
That's correct. So one of the things that we do at Human Rights Studies at UC Davis, is that we train our students to look for the warning signs of genocide. We feel an obligation as scholars in this field to really call out these warning signs in an effort to prevent genocide from happening. And so over the course of the last several weeks, we've been seeing many of what we consider sort of evidence of genocidal intent being expressed by the leadership of Israel. So just pause for a moment. Genocide is an international legal term. It means the destruction of a people, but there has to be behind it the intent to destroy a people in whole or in part. And so we're seeing that in statements from Israeli leadership, from the president of Israel, the prime minister of Israel, to retired generals who in many ways are thought leaders in the country, saying things like what General Giora Eiland said just a couple weeks ago, creating a severe humanitarian crisis in Gaza is a necessary means to achieving the goal of victory. He also wrote, Gaza will become a place where no human being can exist. And when we see the accumulation of statements like this, we're very concerned. We're very concerned that there, what is now a armed conflict can transform or tip very easily into ethnic cleansing and then move from that into full-scale genocide. Mm.
Given that you're a human rights professor, has it been challenging to talk about what has been escalating and unfolding, given understandable emotions that can be at odds with each other? I mean, this all stemmed from October 7th. I mean, it's as if, you know, people are viewing what's happening and escalating death toll through different lenses and different perspectives. Is it tough for you to talk about this as a human rights professor?
It's not tough for me at all. Human rights is a very stable, usable framework for understanding the violation of people's basic rights to life, to dignity, to health. And it's not difficult to talk about it. In fact, we're driven by two core values, which are empathy and consistency. So on the one hand, we seek to understand how people are traumatized and negatively affected by what's happening in the world around them. When we look at these violations of human rights, we look at what's happening in Gaza and in Israel, we use the same standards that we'd want to use if these violations were happening in the Western Hemisphere or Ukraine or in Pakistan or in East Africa. So no, I don't find it difficult to call out the violations of human rights.
How should people talk about these situations, use the right language while recognizing the immense destruction and human suffering?
So this is where I want to get back to this idea of empathy and consistency. And these are not sort of just kumbaya terms. These are terms that are based on real laws, real international laws that have been put in place since the beginning with the end of the Second World War. And the most important of these is the Fourth Geneva Convention. So at the end of the Second World War, the global community got together and they looked at what had happened around the world. They looked at Nazi atrocities. They looked at attacks on civilians. They looked at the Holocaust and they said, this can't happen again. And so a body of law, a body of international law was created that has a very unambiguous core idea, which is that during conflict, civilians are not to be targeted, and that militaries, and I don't care if it's the Israeli military or the Hamas terrorist organization, that they must take special precautions, that's the word that's used, to minimize civilian casualties. And with a death toll in Gaza now coming close to 12,000 people, nearly 5,000 of whom are children, and over 3,000 of whom are women, it's becoming very difficult for me as a human rights scholar to really take seriously Israeli statements that they are not engaged in practices that are putting civilians in unnecessary harm.
Yeah, there have also been calls among some people in positions of power for both a ceasefire and or a humanitarian pause in the fighting. What is the difference between the two?
So ceasefire and humanitarian pause, neither of which have sort of standing under an international law, right? So very much they're in the eye of the beholder. A humanitarian pause in this case means an effort to stop the fighting temporarily so that supplies could be brought in. A ceasefire usually takes place in anticipation of negotiations for peace, right? That and a military like Israel is loath to agree to a ceasefire until it has achieved its war aims. I think we have to note that most of the countries of the world have asked for a ceasefire. And only a handful of countries, including our own, have stood in the way of an official United Nations call for that.
Well, the White House recently announced that daily humanitarian corridors were agreed to by the Israeli government. But do these fit the description of a pause? Are they actually helping civilians in Gaza?
So I think that the best way to think about the impact of these humanitarian pauses is to think about the situation at Ashifa Hospital, the largest hospital in Gaza, a very modern facility with doctors who are really well-trained, nursing staff and so on, who are facing a situation where daily people are dying under their care because of a lack of electricity, a lack of medicine. We've all seen the pictures on the cover of the New York Times of premature babies being huddled together in order to keep them warm. We also know that dialysis patients, chemotherapy patients are unnecessarily dying because of the lack of very simple things like electricity. And Israel, under international law, is also bound to take special precautions to make sure that hospitals are not attacked and that basic needs of hospitals are maintained. And in my saying this, I'm not saying anything different than what President Biden said this morning as well.
Hmm. What about the killing of members of the UN agency in Gaza? That's the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. In addition to journalists, the Committee to Protect Journalists, as of today, 42 journalists and media workers were confirmed dead, 37 Palestinian, 4 Israeli, 1 Lebanese, 9 reported injured, 3 others missing, 13 reported arrested. You know, aren't these individuals, and with the UN Relief and Works Agency, as of this week, 102 staff have been killed. Aren't these individuals, civilians, protected under international humanitarian law?
Absolutely. More UN officials, more UN workers have been killed in the last month than in the two decades before. So these are 101, 102 That's updated from last night when I looked it up. Humanitarian workers for the United Nations Relief Work Agency have been killed. And what does UNRWA do? That's what we call it. These are teachers. These are administrators of programs. These are social workers. These are nurses. These are daycare workers. These are people who help civil society in Gaza exist. And with their death, they're going to be absent from any effort to rebuild Gazan society. So this is a terrible blow to any effort for Gazans to rebuild, to have the dignity of access to, for their children to school. Yes, the Committee for the Protection of Journalists noted that 42 journalists have been killed so far. But also, you know, as a university professional, I'm interested and concerned about what's happening to higher education in Gaza. The Palestinian Ministry of Higher Education, located in Ramallah, has told us that 427 university students have been killed so far, including 12 academics. And the reality is 88,000 young people in Gaza and the West Bank are not able to attend university right now. Again, denying them a basic human right, which is a human right to education. So we're looking at a situation where the Israeli decision to invade and attack Gaza in the way that it has provides mounting evidence that it is violating international human rights and humanitarian law. But what it's also doing is destroying the civil and the civilian infrastructure of Gazan society, which will create a very difficult situation for Gazans once peace comes, if it ever does. Mm-hmm. And so all of these things combined tell us that the situation on the ground in Gaza is that Israel is acting in a way that is disproportionate to the threat, which is another key human rights legal doctrine.
You're talking about a scale of loss that can be difficult, if not impossible, to fully comprehend. I mean, especially when people are taking in an increasing death toll, you know, over 11,000 Palestinians reported in Gaza by health officials there, around 1,200 in Israel, according to authorities there. Are we really able to understand the gravity behind these figures, right, behind these numbers?
So as I said, there's this, you know, key idea in human rights studies of empathy and consistency. So consistency, we really want to understand the numerical and the data-driven impact of what's happening. Empathy is when we try to understand the human side. And we talk often about this phenomenon called the numbness and dumbness of numbers, the numbness and dumbness of numbers, meaning that when we're confronted with these large numbers, we as human beings just don't have an opportunity to understand the real-world impact of what those mean. And so we always have to remind ourselves that behind the 4,600-plus number of children are parents, are mothers and fathers, many of whom probably were also killed alongside their children. We have to understand what it means to a society to lose doctors, to lose teachers, to lose college students. We have to understand this, and I think we have to understand how this impacts Israeli society as well, that this is why, after the end of the terrible events of the Second World War, we created this system, right? And that we created this system to hold all nations of the world accountable to a very basic standard. And unfortunately, it appears that Israel is failing to adhere to the basic standard.
And all of us are taking it in. I mean, it's easy to find, you know, constant developments, understandably so, also on social media. The imagery is devastating. How do you recommend people engage with staying up to date on what's unfolding and what's escalating?
I think this is a really wonderful question, and I don't have a great answer to this, aside from listening to NPR. But I think that when we permit ourselves to be deluged by images without comment, especially recognizing that there's a tremendous amount of misinformation that's being promoted, when we listen to unchallenged statements by military spokesmen, Hamas spokesmen, State Department spokesmen, and women spokespeople, we really make ourselves vulnerable to swallowing one narrative or the other. And this is, I work with my students a lot on this, and unfortunately, they get a lot of their news from social media and from TikTok, which is image-driven. And so I encourage people to go to the old media, to spend time with the LA Times or the New York Times, to read the Jerusalem Post, to listen, to read the updates in Al Jazeera or BBC News. I think the most important idea is to multiply your sources of information rather than to narrow them. But again, if you just take in the images, it makes you even more vulnerable to the numbness and dumbness of numbers.
There have also been here at home, also in other countries around the world, instances and accusations of anti-Semitism, Islamophobia. You're a human rights professional. I mean, how should people respond to what's happening, to these prejudices that are taking place?
And again, this is where empathy and consistency is important. Anti-Semitism is real. It happens in American society. It is present throughout the world. Anti-Semitism is hatred and prejudice against Jewish people, but also against an imaginary figure of the Jew. It's a very old prejudice that seems to be very difficult to stamp out. And then Islamophobia is a similar pattern of fear and hatred, where there is prejudice and discrimination against Muslims, but also against Arabs. And it's important to understand that that there are Christian and Muslim and Jewish Arabs around the world who are facing similar acts. And what brings these two ideologies together, and this is one of the things that has generated our concern about genocide, is that at their heart it's a dehumanization, right? And we know when we study war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and genocide, that one of the very first things that takes place is the dehumanization of the other, because it becomes a lot easier to kill them, to deny them their humanity, to deny them their dignity. So it is real. It is real, both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia on campus and in American society. But one of the things that we're concerned about as human rights professionals is where the accusation of either anti-Semitism or Islamophobia is used to suppress legitimate speech, especially the legitimate criticism of the state of Israel, just like we should be able to criticize any state for its actions. And so I have to say, at UC Davis, I've not seen the kinds of anti-Semitism or the kinds of Islamophobia that I've seen at other campuses.
I was going to ask, you know, as an academic, you're on campus at UC Davis. At other colleges across the country, including here in California, there have been demonstrations and protests that at times can conflict with each other. Students can have different views and conflict and be at odds with their own professors. You know, can you give us a sense of what the environment is like at the UC Davis campus?
So first, I think it's wonderful when students are at odds with their professors. Right. I think it's wonderful when students can have civil discussions, can take a stand, are willing to protest, to demonstrate, to help other people understand their position. And I think we've been relatively successful at UC Davis in making sure that kind of environment is available to all. In fact, last night I had an opportunity to have a conversation with the leadership of the Students for Justice in Palestine, which is one of the leading sort of advocates for Palestinian rights. On other campuses, other chapters, primarily large private universities driven by private donations, Students for Justice in Palestine has been banned from campus, and that's certainly not happened at UC Davis. And they report to me that they feel that they have no major complaints, that the university has not provided them with a legitimate space for protest. They've raised concerns about surveillance by other students and other student groups, but also have identified moments when they have been exposed to hate speech and so on, but not to the degree that I think is happening elsewhere. And I think one thing that's very important to understand about what we've been able to do through human rights studies at UC Davis is that several of the leaders of Students for Justice in Palestine have taken my genocide courses, and they have engaged in the formal study of anti-Semitism, the Holocaust, other genocides, and really, I think, have understood, this is the empathy part again, the collective suffering of the Jewish people in the past, and recognize both strategically and intellectually how anti-Semitism is ultimately also destructive to their cause.
Professor Watson-Paul, as always, thank you for the conversation.
Thank you very much, Vicky.
Keith David Wantonpaul is a professor and director of human rights studies at UC Davis, and he's discussing the human rights challenges during the ongoing Israel-Hamas war, which has entered its second month. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There are more than 200 animal shelters across California, and many are facing a growing dilemma: caring for more animals with less staff. Money doesn't seem to be the main driver, but an ongoing veterinarian shortage that escalated during the pandemic. A study this year from the San Francisco SPCA, as well as UC Davis, they looked at the shelters that have budgeted positions for veterinarians and nurses and found that more than half of those positions remain vacant, which means hundreds of thousands of shelter animals across the state don't have access to reliable veterinary care, with consequences that include overcrowding, higher instances of illness, and euthanasia. Front Street Animal Shelter in the city of Sacramento is among the sites being impacted. Dr. Victoria Smalley is Front Street's only full-time veterinarian and joins us with a closer look at the challenges. And joining us also, joining Dr. Smalley, is Dr. Kate Hurley, director of the UC Davis Corret Shelter Medicine Program, which partnered for the study. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
So, Dr. Smalley, I want to start with you. Last week, the city of Sacramento, they published an article on its website about how Front Street Animal Shelter is adapting amid an ongoing veterinarian shortage. You are the shelter's only full-time veterinarian. When did this problem start to arise?
It started to arise shortly before I came to the shelter. I've been with the shelter for a little over a year. And before then, they had two full-time veterinarians on staff. I was originally hired to be a part of their homeless outreach program and to be the full-time veterinarian for that program. And when I started, we lost our two full-time veterinarians that were solely in the shelter.
Wow. Well, during the height of the pandemic, I mean, I thought, and this was the first thought that came to mind when I took in the study as well as the article from the city, I thought pet adoptions increased, right? As
they
people
did.
Were sheltering at home, you know, social distancing, they wanted that comfort. So what has happened since then? And has that played a role in the challenges that you're facing now?
Yes, we did definitely see an increase in adoptions during the pandemic. And I think as people started going back to work full time and being recalled into the office, having a pet was no longer able to be part of their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Many people have made it work, but we do see some return to the shelter. We also see, you know, the typical puppies and kittens coming into the shelter that we've always seen. There was a large disruption in veterinary care during the pandemic because as you know, citizens, we were impacted by the stay-at-home mandates as well. And with the shortage of veterinarians, we have veterinarians retiring, leaving the profession altogether to pursue other interests. And so I think it's been this sort of storm to where we are now.
Yeah. There's a lot of dynamics at play that happened within a relatively short period of time. We're talking just over 3 years. Mm-hmm. What do vet services at your shelter, what do they look like today?
We provide all sorts of medical services. Obviously, we do the vaccines, the preventative medicine. Spays and neuters are a huge portion of what we do. I'm pretty lucky at my shelter at Front Street. We have a great support system where we're able to do more in-depth medical procedures for a lot of our shelter animals. And so doing all of those things with the shortened veterinary community, veterinary doctors and technicians, it does put a strain on us. And so we have to sort of triage. We do the most important things. We take care of emergencies. We see emergencies, you know, animals that have been hit by cars, all sort of things in the shelter. We see it all.
You know, when I was reading that article from the city, I mean, you said that Front Street is currently caring for over 700 animals. Mm-hmm. What would you like that number to be? What is a normal number?
You know, I've only been there a year. It's way above what we call capacity of care. So in our shelter, we have animals that are often doubled up in their kennels, which you would see, which isn't ideal, but we make it work. We do our best. We have wonderful support staff that help these animals to be able to be co-housed. So I'd like to get that down to single numbers in the shelter. Mm-hmm. We're also really fortunate that the majority of our animals are in foster care. And so we have two types of programs. We have basically fosters where people are just fostering an animal to get them out of the shelter, or like puppies and kittens until they grow up a little bit. And then we also have a program where you can foster an animal with the intention to adopt it. And they stay in the foster program until they can get spayed and neutered, and then the adoption takes place.
Yeah, and I can imagine that tremendously helps when it comes to capacity, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
Yeah, Dr. Hurley, you're the program director for the Shelter Medicine Program at UC Davis. You know, and I was talking to Dr. Smalley at Front Street Animal Shelter about the challenges that they're facing amid a veterinarian shortage. You know, what are you seeing and hearing from other animal shelters across the state, given that, you know, you just conducted a study earlier this year?
Yeah, we're seeing the same phenomena that Dr. Smalley describes writ large across the state. We knew that there was a crisis in access to care and shelters, but I have to say we were dismayed when we understood sort of the depth and extent of it and the way that it's impacting shelter animals. We found that over 60% of shelters that have full-time positions for veterinarians have at least one unfilled position. So that's 6 out of 10 shelters driving a car with at least one wheel missing. And of course, you know, when you're missing one staff member, that puts more pressure on the remaining staff and tends to have sort of a snowball effect. And we're already seeing the harms that it's creating for shelters. 25% of shelters we surveyed weren't even able to provide sort of basic care like vaccination and parasite control and intake, or care for routine illness like just common colds for dogs and cats. And 2/3 are unable to provide intermediate care, and that includes spay-neuter, which is required before animals can be adopted out into homes in California. So it's really having an impact on a lot of different levels. 80% of shelters were finding that their ability to support community members to keep animals safely out of the shelter were limited by just being unable to recruit veterinary staff. Mm. And almost 1/3 are finding that they're already seeing an increase in euthanasia as a result.
Yeah, what I was learning from the study and what you just laid out, you know, money isn't necessarily the biggest issue. I mean, these shelters, they have the funding, they have the resources to hire, but these positions remain vacant. Can you shed some light as to why there isn't a larger pool of veterinarians and other staff?
Well, what we're seeing in shelters is something we're seeing across the veterinary profession, and we're seeing it in other fields as well. Sort of in these post-COVID times in healthcare as well. And for anyone who's tried to get a pet in to see a veterinarian in the last few years, you may also have experienced that at your own clinic, there's limited appointments or it's hard to get a pet in to see an emergency vet. And so we're seeing just more competition for every open position. I mean, for every veterinarian available, there might be 15 or 20 positions for them to choose from. So shelters are competing for that. And also, when we see populations start to build up in shelters, that becomes daunting for veterinarians and veterinary technicians, as Dr. Smalley was describing, 700 animals in care when really there should be maybe 200 that would be more within their capacity. That, you know, again, that can create a snowball effect where that becomes a very stressful environment to work in. Veterinarians are, you know, we get into this because we love animals. And it's really hard to be in a position where you feel like you just can't provide the kind of care that you know the animals deserve. And so it's something that it's really important that we start to unravel that and create a more positive working environment for veterinary staff and all shelter staff, so that we can have shelters fully staffed up, so we can do the work needed to prevent animals from coming in, so we can lower those populations in the shelter.
Yeah, Dr. Smalley, I mean, what Dr. Hurley just laid out, I mean, when we think about, you know, burnout, you know, especially during the pandemic, we think of frontline workers like, you know, emergency responders, you know, hospitals, teachers, veterinarians, too. I mean, the fact that you're dealing with an overwhelming load of animals to care for, that you want to care for, but you just don't have the staffing or the resources, I mean, that also must carry an emotional toll as well.
There definitely is an emotional toll. I think I've been in a veterinarian for 16 years now. I've seen a lot of things in my career. And I think I've definitely learned to sort of compartmentalize it. So for every win, you know, I sort of takes away the negative. And at the end of the day, I'm working for a better positive outcome for these pets. And those wins are just huge. And yeah, there are times where there's tears involved. We get attached to our shelter animals. But at the end of the day, I look forward going in every day knowing that I'm going to make a difference in a pet's life, in an adopter's life, and use that to outweigh the negative, because sometimes it's really stressful and sometimes it's just ongoing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we look into hobbies. We take care of our mental health, which is a big thing for veterinarians. And I have the most wonderful support staff at the shelter, and they make every day a joy. So even when it's rough.
Yeah. Dr. Hurley, you also previously worked at animal shelters. And when I was reading your bio, you moved on to the UC Davis Caret Shelter Medicine Program. You were the first in the world to undertake a residency in shelter medicine. And that was back in 2001. What drew you to shelter medicine?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, I'd worked in a shelter for 6 years before I went to vet school, mostly as an animal control officer. And when I was in vet school, I learned some things that were so simple and yet so transformative for the way we could have done our work in the shelter. I'll give you just one example. Every day for those 6 years, I spent hours every day cleaning the kennels to try and prevent disease, and especially a severe disease called canine parvovirus, which some of the listeners will be familiar with. That's something that can often be fatal in dogs, and especially if your dog isn't vaccinated, as the animals coming into shelters often aren't. And I learned in vet school that the disinfectant I used had been proven ineffective against parvo like 10 years earlier. And I just thought, oh my God, how can it be that this information that is known by veterinarians is not being passed along to animal shelters? There was just this disconnect between the veterinary profession and the sheltering profession. And that's why it's so heartbreaking to me to see this lack of veterinarians in shelters now, that getting involved with shelters over the last couple of decades has been so transformative for veterinarians and for sheltering. You know, the great work that it's just great work to be able to do. And it's really helpful to bring those two fields of animal care together and in alignment.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever come across a time as challenging as this as a veterinarian, Dr. Hurley? I mean, are there parallels to draw from?
I think, you know, when I was working in a shelter in the early 90s, 1,000 years ago, it was more challenging in that there were more animals coming in, euthanasia rates were higher. But I've not found a time as challenging as this in terms of the knowing that it could be better. We've seen it be better. We know how it can be. And it's so frustrating to not be able to realize the potential that we know is there. I think there's something particularly disheartening about that.
Do you think the culture has also changed where more pet owners are seeking care for their animals more than perhaps a couple decades ago? And that maybe is contributing to a growing industry which can compete, you know, because they're competing for the same positions from a shelter to a private practice.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very positive spin on it. And I hope that that is part of it, that pet owners are seeking more care. But also, we know that there's an enormous pool of pet owners who don't have any access to care and never have. And when we consider serving that population, the gap between the veterinarians that there are and the amount of care that's needed becomes even more daunting.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about an ongoing veterinarian shortage at animal shelters across California and how it is impacting the care of shelter animals. I do want to devote some time to solutions. Dr. Smalley, you touched upon this in the beginning, but how is Front Street adapting to lessen the harmful impact of this vet shortage?
We are doing a few things. Right now, we're very fortunate we have a large pool of contract veterinarians or relief veterinarians that come in, and they help us with the surgeries required and some of the medicine. And we have our schedule full right now, and that's a very positive thing. I wouldn't be able to do it without them. I've got a great support staff, technicians, animal care technicians, and they all want to know about the medicine, so they're able to help, you know, identify diseases in the shelter or animals that aren't doing well. So that's been the biggest thing, is having these contract vets come in and having an organization that supports that to get the things needed done.
Dr. Hurley, since this study came out earlier this year, I mean, how is it helping shape, you know, the best and the most realistic way to respond to a shortage that is impacting the quality of care and the quality of life of shelter animals?
Well, funny you should mention that. We're doing a follow-up. We're working right now on a follow-up survey and some work to think about what are some short and medium-term solutions, including what education and training could we provide, perhaps, to increase the skills and efficiency of the veterinarians and staff that are working in shelters. Maybe, you know, by speeding up their spay-neuter ability, we could get more done by the same veterinarian and also help increase retention, because veterinarians and veterinary technicians love to learn. We're looking at what are the factors that lead to retention of veterinarians in shelters. Maybe there are some things that directors can do to help attract and retain talented medical staff. And also sort of looking long term, what are some legislative and policy solutions that might support more veterinary presence in shelters as well as in communities?
Yeah, I was going to get to that, because there are two new laws that the governor signed that impact veterinary care. One of them, it allows veterinarians to provide virtual care. Do you think this will be useful? Dr. Hurley, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think that anything that we can do to increase access to veterinary care in general is going to improve the conditions in shelters, partly because it will help keep animals out of shelters. You know, sometimes a simple phone call to a veterinarian could result in treatment that would solve a problem where otherwise the pet might have ended up being surrendered to a shelter. So I think that's going to help. I think by improving the efficiency of the veterinarians that are in practice, that'll just open up more veterinarians to play additional roles potentially in shelters, and some potential direct role for telemedicine to support shelters themselves.
Dr. Smalley, how could telemedicine help you at Front Street?
So immediately what it'll do, we do have a homeless outreach program, and because we're short-staffed veterinarians, I am only able to go out once a week. So now I have technicians that are out in the field. So normally, these animals are surrendered for medical care, and I try to get to them when I can. So I think it's going to be a huge benefit for me. I'll be able to video, you know, something in the field with one of my technicians and be able to prescribe medications right then and there. It'll take away, both bills will take away the need for me to actually talk to the owner to develop a relationship with them and still be able to provide care. My technicians will be able to do that now. I'll be able to kind of be in two places at once. It won't be perfect, but it'll be a lot helpful to keep the animals that are part of our homeless population out of the shelter.
Yeah, because the second law actually allows registered vet techs that you were just talking about to take on new responsibilities following the permission of a licensed veterinarian like yourself. So this second law would also be useful for you at the shelter.
Very much so.
And finally, I want to end with the community. You know, so many people love animals. You know, we may just have one or two or a lot more. But what can the community do in response to this issue and to, you know, what I think is a crisis? Dr. Smalley?
I think for us, one would be patience. You know, we're doing the best that we can with what we have and trying to get the animals spayed and neutered out of our shelter, trying to come up with some great ways to keep them from coming into the shelter, and just to be patient with what we are trying to accomplish, because they only see the end product. They don't see what's going on behind the scenes. And I know that some community members can get frustrated with that. And we are working so very hard just to make the lives of the shelter population more manageable and happy.
Dr. Hurley, what would you like pet owners to take away from the study and this conversation?
Yeah, as Dr. Smalley said, I think just showing a little extra kindness. These are tough times. If you've got some room in your heart, you want to bake some dog biscuits and bring them on down, maybe some chocolate chip cookies, I think those would be welcome. All the usual things, foster, volunteer, donate, adopt. But I want to mention one thing that might be surprising. Shelters are so full of big dogs right now, every shelter in California. You know, if you go to Front Street, you'll see them doubled up in kennels, and that's tough. And most of those dogs come in as strays. And most of the dogs that come in as strays don't go back to their owners, fewer than half. And so if you find a dog out and about, just doing his thing, doop-de-doo, try and see if you can find the owner. without bringing it into the shelter, even if you can give it a few hours or a day, post it on Nextdoor and social media, put some signs up, knock some doors, or be that person in your neighborhood who knows how to keep dogs out of the shelter and get them back to their owners without a trip into Front Street or another overcrowded shelter. That is a great way that community members can support shelters right now, because by keeping one big dog out of the shelter, you make room for one that really does need to come in and makes it more likely it can get the care it needs, even with the veterinary shortage that we're facing.
Dr. Hurley and Dr. Smalley, thank you so much for the conversation and the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Victoria Smalley is the veterinarian at Front Street Animal Shelter in the city of Sacramento, and Dr. Kate Hurley is the director of the UC Davis Caret Shelter Medicine Program. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Our state is home to a seemingly endless landscape of natural beauty, but exploring and experiencing some of the most beautiful parts of California can be difficult. It can also be cost prohibitive. Fees at state parks and the expense of actually getting there can really start to add up, making much of what our state has to offer not really accessible to a lot of people. Now there is a way to see most of California's state parks for free, and it only takes a library card to make it happen. CAP Radio's Nicole Nixon joins us with more. Nicole covers state politics, government, and elections for CAP Radio and the CAP Radio Network, which serves public radio stations across California. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
So this seems like a screaming deal. A library pass can get you into a state park for free, $0. Please explain.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds good and it is good. Public libraries in California have a bunch of state parks passes available for you to check out for free. All you need is that library card. And I actually tested this out for a story and it works just like checking out a book. You can go online to kind of reserve it. I picked it up a couple days later at my local library and then used it to get in for free at a state park and go on a hike.
You know, how did this program come about and who were they envisioning to use these free state park passes?
Yeah, this program is, it's actually a pilot program. It started in 2021. The state had a very big surplus that year. So they spent a little bit of money to put 5,000 state parks passes into public libraries around California. And it was so successful that year that it grew the next year to 33,000 passes, and they're in every public library in the state. When the state created this program, they also created a new pass, another pilot program that lets every fourth grade student in the state get a free pass to get into a handful of state parks. And the goal of these programs is to get people outside and to improve access to nature in California's state parks, also connecting people with their local libraries to go check it out and get that pass.
Yeah. OK, so it's been well received. There's now more than 30,000 state park passes for free available at public libraries across the state. Did you get an idea of what this means to people being able to experience nature and the outdoors when it's been challenging, you know, before 2021?
Right. So I talked to the State Parks Foundation for this story. They are the nonprofit group that really pushed for this. And one of their goals is to get people outside into nature, into state parks, and make it easier for people. They actually did a survey this year of people that have checked out the library passes. They surveyed 3,600 people and found that 63% were people of color. Nearly 70% of their survey respondents said that they had an income of $60,000 or less. And nearly two-thirds of people said that their main reason for not having visited a state park previously was cost. So, you know, that these numbers really were exciting to the State Parks Foundation. They say that it shows that this pilot program is meeting its goal of improving access to nature, and they're going to push for it to be expanded.
Yeah, because people might think, you know, oh, I'm going to go enjoy the outdoors, but there actually is a dollar sign attached to that. I mean, the park pass to get in, not to mention the gas, if you're staying in a hotel, food and beverages, right, especially if if you have a family. So I would imagine that, you know, that removes a significant barrier for a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, getting there, making sure you're prepared with the right equipment. Equipment is expensive.
Right. Yeah.
And there's another possible solution to that at the library we can talk about later. But for somebody without a lot of financial resources, those things really add up. So removing one barrier, the entry fee, and, you know, if you're going to a state park, using this pass to get into a state park, there's a few places near you. So it kind of narrows down the time you spend deciding where to go as well.
Okay, well, let's get into the camping gear. I mean, what kind of program is it already available, or is it taking shape?
So one of the great things about the Sacramento Public Library is they have a program called the Library of Things, and you can check out anything you can think of, you can check out. They have kitchen equipment like cake mixes and cake mixers and cake pans. They have gardening equipment, power tools. They have gaming consoles, and they have outdoor gear. So you can check out a hiking kit that has hiking poles, a backpack, a compass, and one of these state parks passes.
So there are a lot of state parks in California. I mean, there's more than 200. I think 280. Does this cover all the state parks and the state beaches as well?
It does not. It covers a lot of them, more than 200. So the ones nearby you can get to, Folsom Lake, Auburn, which is where I went for this story. Many of the parks around Lake Tahoe are included, Emerald Bay, Kings Beach. So a lot of options around Sacramento.
Nice. And do you have to be a certain age to be able to, you know, go to the library and get a park pass?
You don't, but it's a vehicle pass. The way it works is it's a vehicle hang tag that waives the vehicle entry fee. So you've got to, you know, drive into the park.
And how many days can you take the park pass? When do you have to return
it? It's the same as if you check out a book. So at the Sacramento Public Library, that's 3 weeks, and 3 weeks of potential weekend adventures.
So often when you go outdoors, you know, you take a big group with you, you know, better in numbers. What if there's more than one vehicle? Do you more than one person, like three drivers, have to go to the library and check out the pass?
Yes. The state park system says it's limited to one car. It's that hang tag that goes on your rear view. And so you can pile as many people into your car as you can and get free entry for everybody. These passes also they only cover the entry fees, so they don't cover like camping or boating fees or any of those extra things.
That is awesome. I mean, when you actually took it in and used it for yourself, I mean, what did you enjoy most about it?
I think it was fun to check out something from the library that wasn't a book. And
right.
Like the few days where I was waiting, I was kind of antsy. The other thing I learned when I went to go pick it up is that it's a very slow season. It's really easy to get these right now. The librarian, when I went and picked it up, told me that they're really in demand over the summer when kids aren't in school. But once school starts again, he's like, oh, there's a whole stack of them under his desk. So it might be as easy as just going to your library, not trying to get online and waiting a few days the way I did, but just go and ask if they have one and then head to the mountains.
What if you're excited, but you're also overwhelmed because there's like more than 200 state parks to choose from? Is there like a way to help guide you in the right direction?
Yes. The state parks website, which is parks.ca.gov, they have a lot of information on this. They have lists of all the parks that are and are not included. So you can just go to your county and find where you can use it. They also have a map where you can find your nearby local libraries and the nearby state parks where you can, you know, go and use it after you pick it up.
Nicole, thanks for, you know, enjoying the outdoors and the fresh air and sharing, you know, us about this cool program.
Thank you.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio state politics reporter, sharing a great deal for visiting state parks, and all you need is a library card. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director and engineer is Mark Jones. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.